This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. Several of his novels have been adapted into films, including Clockers, about crack dealers and cops, and The Wanderers, about street gangs in the Bronx, where Price grew up. Price also wrote the screenplays for the films Sea of Love, Mad Dog and Glory, and The Color of Money. His new novel, Samaritan, is about a guy who, like Price, grew up in a housing project and became a successful writer. The character in the novel, Ray Mitchell, has made a lot of money in L.A. writing for a TV series set in a high school. After September 11th, Ray returns to New Jersey to be near his daughter, who lives with her mother. He also returns to his old neighborhood in the hopes of sharing some of his success by teaching writing at his former high school and even helping some of the people there with their financial troubles. But some of his attempts to do good blow up in his face. In fact, at the beginning of the novel, Ray has nearly been killed by someone he knows, but he refuses to reveal his attacker's identity, which creates two mysteries. Who did it, and why is Ray protecting him? Here's a reading from the chapter in which Ray teaches his first creative writing class.
Okay, let me ask you. This is creative writing. This is volunteer. Somebody tell me why you're here. 'Cause I got stories, said Rashad, his hand half raised. Yes, Ray said almost gratefully. I got stories. You all have stories, whether you know it or not. And here, right here, is where you're going to give them up. He reached into the shopping bag at his feet, pulled out 7 of the 10 red and black writing journals he had bought for them across the river in Chinatown, and dealt them out like playing cards. But, Doctor, I don't have any stories. Oh, indeed you do, my dear. Ray backsliding, doing voices once again, trying to get them to laugh. Although he was too jazzed now to care if they did or didn't. You have crazy mad stories, all of you, everybody here. If I go around the table and squeeze you a little, each and every one of you can give me 6 great stories. That's 6 times 7 kids equals 42 plus 14 between me and Mrs. Bondo here equals 54. 56, said Ephraim. 56, thank you, stories. They're about your friends, your neighbors, your families, most definitely your families. And these are very important stories to you, stories you've grown up with. The time my uncle got so angry that... The day my grandmother left her house thinking that my parents, the first time they met, they, my brother, just 'cause that other kid dated him, I couldn't believe it when he, oh man, my mother, I've never seen her like that when she, and all these stories, they're up here, touching his temple, and in here, touching his heart, corny, but what the hell. And we love them because they're ours, because even if they're not true, and believe me, at least half of these stories are not. They've set up house in us. They're part of us. They are us. Yeah, okay, okay. Talking to himself now more than to them. This is great, great. Okay, this class, forget it, okay? Don't even think of it as creative writing. It's just stories. The writing assignments, stories, telling stories. Can somebody wake this guy up? One of the girls punched the boy, Jamal, whose forehead was resting on the table. Ray, so happy now, stories his lifelong lifeline. To his daughter, to romance, to himself. Stories, the ballast, the crash cart, the air. And the thing is, what are you, Hopewell Projects kids? Neighborhood kids? Oh man, nobody out there knows what you know. And what you may think of as everyday, as boring, that's like, nah, that's me. When I want to read something, a book, a story, a newspaper article, I'm thinking, time is tight. Why should I read this? What does this individual have to tell me that I don't already know? He then checked himself, something off in the message. Not that what you write has to be a showstopper, mind-boggling, or, you know, can you top this? All I am saying is, believe me, you're all so much more interesting, so much more special than you might think. So every week, you're going to write me a few pages. Doesn't have to have a beginning or an end. Just some kind of snapshot, word picture. Bring it in and read it to the class, or I'll read it for you and we'll talk. Questions? Jamal, the sleeper, raised his hand. Does spelling count? The girl with the big framed glasses, Myra, clucked her tongue in irritation. Spelling is good. It's good to have spelling. His disappointment in the question was neutralized by this Myra. Something cooking there. Can we write in pencil? Pencil, pen, blood, as long as I can decipher it. Do they have to be true? Fool me.
Richard Price, do you think that this was a good lesson that he was delivering?
Worked for me.
Yeah, I figured.
I mean, you have. That's how I started. You know, I mean, you start writing, you know, and you look around at your life, and you're 18, and the whole idea of write about what you know can be deadly for somebody who doesn't even vote yet. So, what worked for me, and I think what worked for some of my students over the years, was reaching back into the family mythology and not being, you know, focused on the fact that all you know is that you miss your girlfriend over Thanksgiving vacation and you hate being with your parents.
One of the things Ray is up against as a teacher is that the kids are giving him these kind of prepackaged stories. Talk a little bit about the stories he gets from the students and how that connects with what you found when you were teaching people who had really interesting lives, but that wasn't what was coming back at you with the stories that we're writing.
Well, what happens is that, you know, when you're trying to get kids to write, or trying to get anybody to write who's not a serious writer, rather than think about what's meaningful to them, they try to anticipate what would be meaningful to you. And so the source is always coming from the outside. What does this guy want to hear? What'll get me an A? How do I get this homework assignment as quick as I can? And the irony is that, you know, so they go to television for their stories, or they go to sort of crummy books that they've read, you know, for ideas, when in fact, you know, there's diamonds in the backyard. The minutia of their everyday life is where all the jewels are. And repeatedly I've had to sit kids down and say, why are you writing this? Tell me about yourself. Tell me, your father's a black fireman in a white suburban town? Well, why on earth are you writing about people sniffing angel dust in the South Bronx where you've never been?
Right. Ray and his attempt to reconnect with the people back home and to help them, because he feels this need to help them. He does favors for some of his old students, for some of the new young people that he's meeting, even lending money for some pretty harebrained business schemes. But he gets into a lot of trouble in his attempts to do good. What made you think about the kind of trouble you can get into in your attempt to be generous?
I felt like I've gotten in a lot of trouble, not the type of, you know, mortal peril that Ray gets into. But I found myself in situations with people that were disadvantaged, and I want to do something for them. These people perhaps have helped me out doing the legwork for my earlier books that took place in the same fictional Jersey City. And I get involved in people's lives, either teaching in the public schools or involved with families. And what happens is you can get very excited by your own power to do good, to come down into people's lives and give them things or grant them things. And these things might be material, they might be friendship, they might be just the simple curiosity of another human being the first time somebody in your life has asked you about yourself. How do you make it through your day? And this is very seductive to people, and it's also very seductive to me, who's putting out all this stuff. And it's the dangerous thrill of goodness. At some point, though, the project is over, the relationship sort of diminishes, and I move on. And I've oftentimes felt like I've left people seduced and abandoned, when in fact I can put down on paper, well, I've done this, I've done that, I've done this. It has nothing to do with that. It's about this promise, this intangible promise that you've given them, that you'll always be there, or you're going to show them a certain way, and you open up like the hope door in their chest, and the dogs bark and the caravan moves on and you're gone. And sometimes when people can get wrapped up in their own ability to do good, it's a kind of dangerous, heedless thing, because they don't really know and they can't really appreciate the depth of need and feelings that they're provoking in the people that they're exercising their quote-unquote goodness on. I think Delmo Schwartz said, ego is always at the wheel.
Do you think that this is particularly true when somebody who is or has become pretty middle class or affluent goes into a neighborhood where people are pretty poor and where the family isn't necessarily intact? So there's already been a history of people walking out on you, and a history maybe of, you know, professional social workers, teachers coming in and out of your life and ultimately leaving.
You know, the thing, though, is, yeah, for certain people, for a character like Ray, who is returning from Los Angeles and returning from, you know, the life of being a TV writer, and is not returning to the housing project where he grew up, but to a gated community, and sort of descending on this housing project, you know, trying to be like a good Samaritan. But there are people that are raised age and of raised background who are there every day and understand better how to temper their relationships. I mean, the cops, I don't know about social workers, but teachers, there are people like Ray who have not gone off to Hollywood, who have left the neighborhood to live in the suburbs, but they're back there every day doing their job. And these people have much more of a solid sense of how to relate to people. But it's a huge thrill and a bad thrill for somebody to come in out of the blue and get the gut reaction of thank you, thank you, thank you. Because that thank you could be like heroin. And you'll do anything to keep the thank yous coming. And you hurt people.
So when you were writing Clockers about teenagers who were selling crack on the street, you hung out in New Jersey neighborhoods trying to meet kids who were really in this kind of situation in neighborhoods where this kind of thing was going on. Are those the kids you were talking about that you got to know well?
Yeah, I mean, not anybody in particular. It's just like a general feeling that I found myself sort of going off, getting carried away, and letting my alligator mouth write checks that my hummingbird body couldn't cash. But, you know, it's not about the people, and it's not about the highs and the lows and the haves and the have-nots. It's about someone who's very weak and very needy, and at the same time is very powerful in a very small pool. And even if that neediness is to evoke tenderness in people or to give out tenderness, they're like big Thanksgiving floats, and they get buffeted by the wind. The float hits a light pole. The light pole falls down and kills, three parade viewers, and then the float just moves off. I mean, people that are big like that in a small pool are kind of oblivious to what they're doing to people, and they just go on their merry way.
Is there something that happened between you and somebody who you were trying to help that kind of crystallized this for you in a very personal way?
No. I mean, there were no precipitating incidents. It's just a feeling that I had. And then every once in a while, I'll read about a Good Samaritan who winds up having a bad end for some reason, and the newspapers will always reach for that adjective, beloved, you know, but I don't know. It's just a word that they like to use. And I like to think about what provoked what happened, you know, and how can the angel somehow be actually the devil that precipitated their own doom.
My guest is screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. His new novel is called Samaritan. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Price is my guest, and his new novel is called Samaritan. A lot of the book is about relationships between adults and children, or adults and teenagers. You know, Ray and the students he's teaching, Ray and his former students, and Ray and his daughter. Ray and the son of a young woman who he's having an affair with. And he seems to really want to be a friend and a friend even to his own daughter. I think sometimes he doesn't know he's an adult and that he's got to set limits for the kids.
Kids are so easy. I mean, you know, for somebody who has a neediness like that in them, where they want to see the love of other people show up in other people's eyes, kids are so easy to manipulate, but it never feels like you're manipulating them because you believe yourself in the moment just as you're making them believe in you. I mean, that's not the danger. The danger is at the end of the day when you stop thinking about that kid, because it's not your kid. It was just somebody you could take to a mall that day and tell jokes to and ask questions of that have never been asked of that child before, and make the kid think, this guy really likes me. He cares about me. Nobody's ever been giving to me like this, either verbally or gift wrappingly. And when that kid goes home, you know, his head and heart are forest fires. And this guy just goes home sort of feeling good about himself and turns on the TV and gets on with his evening.
Ray is separated from his wife. And right. When he comes back to New Jersey, he hooks up with his daughter again. But he's very self-conscious around her and realizes he's treating her like a first date. What gave you that image?
Oh, I got a couple of daughters. I use them for practice. it's just, you know, I find myself, I mean, sometimes with my kids, the bad parent part of me is the part of me that feels like it's running for office and needs their votes and sort of like can cater, you know, to what they would like as opposed to doing the more difficult stuff, which is to say, no, you can't do that. You know, and there's a certain weakness in me that I have to fight to be a parent. I mean, it's, you know, it's a big, you know, cliche to say, you know, don't be a friend, be a parent. You know, there's plenty of time for friendship when they turn adult themselves. Right now, they need yes and no. They need guidance, you know. And but basically, I have to struggle with the fact that all I really want them to do is adore me, you know. And I'm running for office, you know. And I catch myself, and I'll pull back. But it's hard work. But that's what I'm saying for people who have this sort of weakness in them, where they just they live to get other people's eyes, getting that gleam in them. You know, children are very dangerous people because they're so easy. And, I mean, you can hurt them. Hurt yourself and not even know.
There's a scene where Ray takes his daughter, his 13-year-old daughter, to the shopping mall and tells her, today a dollar's like a penny. You can spend anything. You can buy anything. And he expects he's really going to be a hero to her. But she gets really angry and sullen and kind of throws on the floor of the things that he's bought her. What's that about?
It's about how easy it is to us underestimate the perceptiveness and intelligence of children and how they can read you like a comic book and have been all their lives if they're yours. And any kid, if not, you know, even if they're not able to put it in words, knows exactly the weaknesses of their parents and knows exactly the strengths of their parents. And it so rarely has anything to do with what comes out of the parents' mouth. I mean, you know, I've been in therapy for, I think, 3,427 years. You know, I've put 11 Shrinks kids through Bennington already, I think. But, you know, and so when I'm talking to my kids, I know exactly what to say to sound, you know, like, you know, sharing and caring and, you know, saying, making the right noises and this and that. But I think what the kids do is they smell you. They don't even listen to what's coming out of your mouth. They look you right in the eye or they arch their nostrils and they know what you really want, what you really value, what you really need. So this daughter would know that Ray, if the easiest way for Ray to be giving is to give something, to literally, and they're in the mall, which is the crucible. And the kid flips out. She doesn't want any more belly button rings. She doesn't want any more, like, skin lotion. She doesn't want anything. She just wants him to shut the hell up.
Richard Price is my guest, and his new novel is called Samaritan. Now, you know, Ray gets this terrible head injury. He's hit over the head with a vase. And, you know, who did it and why they did it is the mystery in the book. Usually in detective stories, the detective gets hit over the head, usually with a gun. He's knocked unconscious, and he awakes with a terrible headache that goes away in a few hours. Whereas, you know, Ray is, he's in serious jeopardy after getting knocked on the head with his vase. And the jeopardy continues because the headaches can come back. There can be long-term consequences. I was wondering if you were thinking a lot about how different a concussion can be in real life from the way it usually is in crime fiction.
Not really. I mean, I was basically thinking of, you know, I just went to a couple of doctor people, friends that I know, and said, give me a real bad concussion, you know, which they proceeded to do. I just wanted enough to know. I mean, basically, the pain that Ray has to live with and the tentativeness of his recovery, he's been taught a lesson. He knows who did this to him, and he knows that down the line it could cost him his life or it could cost him the use of the right side of his body or something like that. And he doesn't want revenge. He doesn't want this person arrested. He's learned something. And what's driving the detective crazy is that there's a certain amount of shame in what he's learned, and that's why he's not telling her. He's protecting somebody, and what she's picking up from him is shame. And when a detective picks up reticence in a victim, They're thinking that here's a person who's more afraid of the truth coming out than of getting justice. That means that this person is hiding something pretty bad. So, of course, the first thing she thinks of has to do with deviant sexuality, pederasty, drug habit, gambling addictions. She goes through a whole checklist of reasons why people would rather live, you know, with their injury, you know, than see justice sought. But it's something greater and more subtle than any of that. And each book is supposed to be about the education of a character. Well, I mean, they both become educated during the course of the investigation.
Richard Price, his new novel is called Samaritan. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. His novels Clockers and The Wanderers were adapted into films. He also wrote the screenplays for Sea of Love, Mad Dog and Glory, and The Color of Money. Price's new novel, Samaritan, is about a guy who, like Price, grew up in a housing project and became a successful writer. In the novel, the main character, Ray Mitchell, has left L.A. after writing for a hit TV series. He's moved back to New Jersey to be near his daughter and to try to help some of the people from his old neighborhood. Now, I think you're in the process of writing a screen adaptation of your new novel, Samaritan, yes?
Not if I can help it. I'm supposed to. Actually, I'm writing an original script with Jonathan Demme right now. I mean, to write a script of your own book, you know, I always say it's like just because you're a dentist, that doesn't mean you have to do your own root canal. I mean, it's a nightmare. You have to sort of debride and tear apart this thing, and you know every word of the 400 pages, and your job now is you got to make it into a 110-page singing telegram, and it's all like going up into the attic to find something. When you open up a book, you know, to find material to write a screenplay, you come down 3 days later with a whalebone corset on, all your old baseball cards, you know, and your great Aunt Fanny's hat. And you now have a 9,000-page screenplay because it's your book and you love every word and you just can't do it. You don't have the discipline. You're not ruthless enough.
So you're not going to do it yourself? You're going to have somebody
else I'm supposed to do it myself. I'm scheming to, like, try to convince the producer to give it to somebody else and let me write a second original. If I have to, I will, but I'd rather not. Life's too short.
Okay, so that means that you can't complain, though, if you don't like the adaptation, right?
You know, I just wish they would make a movie. Even a bad movie is better than no movie. At least have something, you know, I could bring to cocktail parties and complain about.
Were you happy with the Clockers adaptation?
Not really. I mean, there were very good things in it. I mean, Spike Lee is an artist. He's a terrific visual artist, and there was a terrific visuality to it. There were some wonderful things in some of the performances. By and large, it's not the movie that I would have made, but then again, I'm not a filmmaker.
So was the adaptation that was used one that you had written?
Well, it's what I had written and what Spike rewrote. He wrote on top of me. And there was an interesting thing. He said something to me. I had seen his draft of my draft, and I was horrified. And I said, told him so. I just said, this is like cheesecloth. I mean, there's nothing here. And he said to me, and I've never forgotten this, he said, Richard, you're a writer, you're a screenwriter. When you're done with this script, you're gone from the film project. So you put in everything but the kitchen sink. It's like leaving notes all over, for the cleaning lady. You know, do this, do that, right before you, and you're gone. Me, when I write this, I'm the director, so the script is basically notes to myself. I don't have to show this to a director. I am the director. All I need to write down is things I don't want to forget.
Well, do you buy that? I mean, do you think that that's a good
well,
enough reason
for a
cheesecloth
screenplay?
Well, the truth is in the finished
product. Yeah. I don't know. The truth is in the finished product. I mean, as a writer, I'm probably going to be too reliant on language. You know, he's a visual artist, and I don't know. I had mixed feelings about the movie. I was very moved by what I was moved by, and I was very irritated by what I was irritated by.
Do you think that your novels have more dialogue than they did early on?
I don't know. Probably because the reason why I started writing so much dialogue is because my grammar was horrible and there's no grammar in dialogue. And it was just an easy way to get into writing for me. I mean, I'd grown up on, I'm part of the first generation to grow up as much on TV and movies as on literature. I was born in 1949, so during the 50s, a lot of my storytelling chops came from the screen, small and big. And so I wound up, my instincts were all towards, what happens very quickly and who says what. And so, yeah, in the beginning, it was a lot of dialogue. And I just love the way people talk. I mean, my editor, First Samaritan, said to me, no author of mine will ever hand in a book that's all dialogue. And I was, I'm not going to do that, but I mean, I would if I could get away with it. I'm so much happier writing dialogue than the King's English.
When was the last time you picked up one of your early novels, The Wanderer's Ladies' Man, even The Breaks?
When was the last time?
Mm-hmm.
Never. All I see when I look back at this stuff I've written, especially before Clockers, is what I got away with. I never see anything. I'm reading this stuff, and I can't see how it got published. All I can see is the mistakes I've made, which is probably okay. If I thought that this is as good as it's going to get, then I haven't learned anything. But now that my kids are, teenagers, they've both read a few books of mine, and when I was writing these books, I was in my early 20s. The idea of having children is I might as well be a cowboy or something. It just seemed like science fiction to me to have children, when I was writing. And now all of a sudden I've got kids that are about 5 or 6 years younger than I was when I wrote The Wanderers, and they're starting to read it, and they look to see where I am, and they have to read it on the slide, because if I know that they're reading it, I'm going to sneak up behind them and start screaming out, "Don't read that paragraph. I didn't know you were going to read that someday." because there's all this perversity in it, which, when I wrote it, it was just exuberance. But now I've, my own kids are reading this, and it's mortifying. And they both say, "Dad, go away. You go read Stephen Crane or something. I am going to read this book, okay? I'm not going to tell you when I'm reading this book. If I see you coming, I'm going to put the book down." And I go, okay, I'm leaving. And then I crawl back into the bedroom through the other way, sneak up behind them and try to peek over their shoulder and see what part they're at. And next thing you know, my hand comes across over their shoulder. It's like, "Don't read that page," and I have a heart attack because they didn't know I was in the room. It's a wonderful thing. It's like, I have a 16-year-old daughter who's reading Samaritan now, and she doesn't read an awful lot. She's a good writer, and she reads what she reads, but, reading is not one of her major pastimes. And she said, "Hey, Dad, you're a really good writer," and it just felt so nice that she said that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Price, and his new novel is called Samaritan. Do you go back to your old neighborhood much?
Well, I went back to my old neighborhood. That's how this book started. I went back to the projects in the Bronx, and I went back with this detective who I based the Nerys Ammons character on, because this was the extreme corner of her precinct's jurisdiction.
So this would be the projects in the Bronx where you grew up that The Wanderers
the
is based
project.
On, which is your novel about street gangs in the South Bronx.
Right. And I went back. But, the thing is, you can spend your whole life writing about the same people and the same things, and it's okay. You don't have to go anywhere else, because what changes is you. And it's basically a lifetime of refining a vision. I mean, I would never, put myself in the same category as Faulkner, but, obviously he's the example everybody brings up, that little county in Mississippi. But, you write about what you feel compelled to write about, and somehow I always gravitate to the housing projects. I feel like you can live many places in one lifetime, but you're always only from one place. And for me, it would be the Parkside projects in the Bronx. And I will find myself going back there over and over, but each time I'm going to come out and I'm going to write something different. The bricks will stay the same. I'm the thing that's going to change.
Well, not only have you changed when you go back to the projects where you grew up, the projects have changed. I'm sure the neighborhood's changed, the people living in the projects have changed. What are some of the ways
it's
changed?
Well, that was the big shock about Clockers, which is that I'd grown up in the projects, but I'd grown up at a time in the 50s and the early 60s. It was before drugs and before Vietnam and before, everything that happened in America. And the projects worked. People stayed there. because it was clean, good, affordable housing, and you could save money to send the next generation on to college so that generation wouldn't have to return to the projects. And that all changed in the late 60s and early 70s. And when I had gone from The Wanderers, which was about the projects in the 60s, and all of a sudden it's the 1980s, and I'm doing research on Sea of Love, the Al Pacino movie, and I go with a bunch of cops back to a housing project in Jersey City, which is very much, you know, architecturally at any rate, like the projects that I had grown up in, except it was a place that it looked like hell. I had never, I felt like I was in a tiger pit. I'd never seen anything so dire and desperate in my life. And I found myself feeling, wanting so badly to understand what happened in this project or trying to reconnect to this project. And that's what Clockers came out of. But it's just ironic. It's like I've been writing for 30 years, and it seems like I started out with housing projects, and I'm still back at the original project that The Wanderers came out of.
In your novel, Ray takes his 13-year-old daughter, Ruby, to the projects where he grew up. And she asks if her grandma and grandpa liked living there. And he says, here was here. People lived where they lived. You know, that it was different then. You know, you didn't ask, oh, is this right. A good place? Or you just lived where you lived.
Well, at that point, I mean, the thing is, that's a generational difference. Ray has become a financial success. So Ruby, to go back to Parkside, I brought my daughter Genevieve back to Parkside with me. And she's, you know, she's a city kid. She's a Manhattan kid. She's a, you know, she goes, you know, to good, you know, to not, she doesn't go to public schools. You know, she has a good life. And for her to go to the projects, it's like, it's another world for her. And it was hard for her to realize that. And it's not like she had a negative reaction to the place. She was in a kind of a shock. It was so different. And she said that she got very upset. And she wasn't upset by any kind of poverty or anything. She was upset that this was such a big part of my life. And she didn't ever know about this. And now she feels like she has to rethink me, you know, to some extent. You know, my whole resume in her head, my dad resume, you know, has just gotten a little scrambled. But, you know, the point is, when we were there, when my friends and I growing up there, projects were projects. That's where people lived, you know. But even if it was a bad place, like even a kid now, maybe kids are slightly more politicized about being a have-not as opposed to a have. But nobody, it wasn't a ghetto or anything, but let's say it was a ghetto. Nobody in a ghetto thinks of themselves as living in a quote-unquote ghetto. They just live where they live. And everybody around them lives in that place too. And that's life. That's the world. It's kind of a shtetl mentality.
My guest is screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. His new novel is called Samaritan. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. His novels Clockers and The Wanderers were adapted into films. His new novel is called Samaritan. Ray, the main character in your novel, goes back to the old neighborhood and teaches at the school that he's from. He teaches creative writing on a volunteer basis. And he's talking to the students about the importance that books can have in their lives, like how rich it can be to really connect with a book. And I'd like you to read that paragraph. It's on page 43.
Ray, in his effort to get them to think of writing as storytelling as opposed to mandatory homework assignments, has bought books for them to read that he thinks echoes their own personal experience so that they can see that their lives are valid grounds for literature. And he just has a little spiel he gives them. And let me just say something about these particular books. They're mostly written by people who grew up without advantages, some in cities, some rural, hard lives all around. And the reason I chose them for you was because I feel that we read to learn new things, sure, absolutely. But more often than not, what we really get out of the good books we read is self-recognition. We read and discover stuff about life that we already knew, except that we didn't know we knew it until we read it in a particular book. And this self-recognition, this discovering ourselves in the writings of others, can be very exciting, can make us feel a little less isolated inside our own thing, and a little more connected to the larger world.
I thought that was a pretty good description of
I mean, I didn't have to do any legwork for that one.
Yeah. No, but what about the stuff you read now? Do you think you still read for self-recognition, or do you read for other reasons too?
Well, yeah. I mean, I really do believe that people, especially when you're younger, you know, you're reading to find things out about yourself. You know, a really good writer basically holds up a three-dimensional mirror that you've never looked into before, but what the image has always been there, except that nobody's ever held up this particular mirror before. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'll go on campaigns to read because I want to learn more about the Crusades, you know, or whatever. I mean, but I'm still a sucker for writing that can show me myself.
When you're in the middle of writing, do you read any more or less than you otherwise would?
No, I'll read as much. I'll be more careful in what I read. I once made the terrible mistake when I was trying to write the breaks of reading Sophie's Choice and feeling like, and rightfully so, I'm a dead man. And feeling like, okay, no, I've either got to get the Holocaust in this book now or battered women or something. It's like, you know, I don't have any of this stuff in my book. So you got to be really careful. You know, it's like you're trying to sing a song and you have but a different song is playing in the background and you're trying to like maintain the tune.
Yeah.
So, you know, I try to read basically nitwit stuff while I'm writing.
You know, in your early novels, like The Wanderers, The Breaks, Blood Brothers, it was easy to see the main character as being your surrogate. In your later novels, like Freedom Land and Clockers, it didn't seem to really be directly about you in any way, although I'm sure there are experiences based on ones you had. But in your new novel, Samaritan, it's easy to see Ray as a character who shares some of the experiences that you had as being, in some level or another, like your surrogate. Do you feel like you took a break from yourself and then came back to yourself?
Yeah, well,
again?
What happened is, you know, my first four books in some way were self-referential, and there I was, like 32 years old with four autobiographies. I mean, even my therapist was going into a coma, you know, and so I just had to stop, and that's why I got into screenwriting, because I wanted to keep writing, but I just didn't want to have to keep writing about myself. Became a hired pen, and for all the bad things you can say about Hollywood, it did teach me that I can write about people that are not me and, you know, pull it off. So I did that for 8 years, and when I got back to novels, you know, I still was afraid of going back into examining my own navel. But, you know, I got, for personal reasons, got involved in the world of, you know, Clockers and Freedom Land, where there was nobody like me. Samaritan is sort of like a return to thinking about myself a little bit, because I think it's safe now. I mean, 20-odd years have passed. And, you know, like I said, I've been married that time. I have two children. I didn't have any kids. And I think my life has changed enough that I feel like I have some things to say that are clean and fresh, at least about myself, to myself. And I think, once again, I feel a little bit like I am valid grounds for literature again, hopefully.
But writing about a character like yourself, when you have a wife and children, can be complex too, because they might see some of the characters as being similar to them, or they might see some of your character's thoughts as being like your thoughts. And here's like a sensitive one. Your character's thinking about the difficulty of remaining monogamous in marriage, because you get to know the other person's body so well. It's kind of like making love to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not something a wife would really want to read.
Well, but, you know, it's, you know, hey, I mean, they do call it fiction. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You know, somebody knows you. Help. I mean, somebody, you know, listen, somebody knows you.
Exactly.
And they know what
right.
you do for a living.
Exactly.
And they know what it's like to be with you, and they know how you feel about them. And you would hope that they can read something, be they your spouse or your kids, and know what artistic license is. I would never write anything that I felt that somebody close to me would read and feel betrayed. I mean, I would instinctually feel like it's okay to write this because they know the story.
It's interesting that you say that, because some writers, on the other hand, feel like, well, that the writing comes first, and writers, it's just part of the profession that you end up betraying people who you care about.
Well, see, this is why I would be a horrible journalist, because my philosophy is, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. you know, I know that there are certain people that, you know, and I do believe that. I feel, you know, there are times when I feel like if I was by myself in this world, you know, I might be a more unrelenting writer. I might be more productive writer. I might have more freedom to write about certain things. But, you know, you don't ever begrudge the things that tie you in to your life, because those are the things that will give you the riches to write about, you know, and beware what you wish for, too. But, you know, I'm very sensitive, especially with my work, because everybody after Clockers and Freedomland associates my work with some kind of journalistic realism. And it's all made up. I mean, I might have, like, spent an awful lot of time and know the parameters of reality so I can lie responsibly so that somebody who really lives in this world won't throw the book down in disgust saying this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. But it's all fiction. I mean, everything is kind of made up. You know, but especially, like I said, going back to my wife and kids, I mean, I would, you know, it's just not worth it. You know, I mean, I would never sort of use them as like human sacrifices. Myself, that's another thing. I don't mind.
Right. Well, Richard Price, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Richard Price's new novel is called Samaritan.